Welcome to the What's Hot in Fantasy panel. Right, I have Richard Morgan.
I'm Trudy Gannon.
Got Teresa. I'm another
one.
Okay. What's Hot in Fantasy? You know, when I read that I was on this panel, I went, I don't know. I thought the last question you asked, because 2 years back I had chronic fatigue, and for about 3 years I couldn't read. Because I've got back, and I'm supposed to lie down when I read, and when I lay down to read, I fall asleep. So for 3 years, I didn't read anything. And rest, I'm sort of actually curious to know the answer myself, because I've now just started to being able to read again. So what I did was, I thought, well, what's the point of having all these, you know, great connections when I don't use them? I emailed my editor in the UK, and I emailed my publisher in Australia, and said, what's Hot in Fantasy? Help me out, please. And they gave me a fantastic amount of information, more than I expected. The first thing was my Australian publisher said, her first response was, for now you should know that assassins are the new dragons. Okay, I'm thinking, does that mean assassins are now old hats? But I think what she means is that assassins are the latest thing. She handed it on to Sean Cotterley, the marketing manager, and he gave me like this whole sort of very, you know, account sales and statistics and stuff sort of answer. He said, fantasy sales have increased year on year for the last 2 years. There was a drop in fantasy sales in 2005, but it was back off the extremely big years, which were mainly driven by the Lord of the Rings movies. So Lord of the Rings movies sort of inflated the sales. So it's dropped off and then it's steadily risen. So he's got 2006 sci-fi fantasy total market was 24 million, isn't it? 24 million retail sales? $24 million in retail sales. 2007 was 30.2, I suppose. 2008 was 32.5, maybe. So that was an increase between 6 and 7 of 24.6%. And increased the next year of 7.32%. So basically, sales, fantasy sales have been increasing, which is really nice to know in this global economic crisis. Then he said, currently we're seeing the rise of the crossover YA novel as illustrated by the success of the Twilight Saga and the Eragon series. These series, as well as the Harry Potter series, have broadened the fantasy market, and as the younger generation grow up, they will continue to read in the genre.
They will.
He said, paranormal is on the rise with sales across a wide range. The volumes per title aren't huge, but the pure number of titles selling makes this an area that is growing strongly. The number one author in this area is Laurel K. Hamilton, followed by Sherilyn Kenyon. So not second and not second line. Most of the bestsellers in 2008 were from known authors, which indicates fans are staying loyal to their favourites. There were only two debut authors that broke up the top 20 last year, and they were Brent Weeks and Dorothy Hurst. That's interesting because Brent Weeks' story is apparently about assassins. So, second person said assassins. Fantasy is still the dominant subgenre in speculative fiction, outselling sci-fi, paranormal, and horror. So, this is a great long list. I wish the top 20, Jennifer Fallon is number 17. Sarah Douglas, I'm looking for Australian authors here. Sarah Douglas is 6 and 7. Yeah. I don't think there's any other Australian on that list.
I guess we won't talk about that.
So, if anything, it's good there's some of us in there. Stephanie.
Surprise.
Interestingly enough, number two is Raymond O'Fast, and he's been around for that loyalty. And of course, Wicked by Gregory Maguire. The show, of course, is going to be increasing sales. And he finishes off with, on a personal note, I think readers are now looking for well-constructed stories that are character-driven rather than classic dragons, trolls, and elves adventure story. Although there is still a place for the style for the Call of Fantasy fans, if the genre is to continue to grow more non-traditional, fans need to be attracted to the genre. So anyway, I've got to hold it for my UK, so I might move along from there. Well, the reason that, as I was talking about attracting a wider audience, that's the reason you'll see less of a dragon and somebody, you know, bow and arrow on the front of a jacket. You see more of these sort of a black jacket with just an image. You know, we're going, you know, Robin Hobb's just gone through a major rejacketing. Who was the other one we just did? Rain Feist. All of his backlist, beautiful new jackets. And Fiona. Now that jacket, we actually, the sales team, worked long and hard to have that jacket. There was two jackets, and the one they showed us was a standard sort of fancy jacket, and then we saw this was the hardback jacket. And all the sales people went, I want this one. And it's worked. And it's gone really strong for us. So we're very happy with Fiona. And we've got the next one coming out soon. So I'm in sales. Mr. Sean Kotcher used to be my boss. And so everything that he said was sort of like what I was going to say. Sorry, I shouldn't swear. The paranormal is big, but that's only going to be big for so long. You know, by Christmas time, crash and burn, and we're looking for the next big thing, which is just a standard, basic, wonderful fantasy adventure. And, yeah, throw an assassin in.
I actually have a theory that goes really well with those two.
Yeah.
You know, in the 90s, Izzy was a vampire and Anne Rice and all that was really popular. Yay, vampires. And then along came Buffy and was like, kill all the vampires. So we went from vampires to vampire hunters. We've got vampires now. And if assassins are cool, we'll cycle through again. We'll suddenly have, hey, vampire hunters. Let's kill the vampires.
Interesting. I did some stats in preparation. It's mainly because, like, I think someone else said, you know, perhaps they don't read absolutely everything, and coming to SwanCon I tend to come up here and feel I've got a disadvantage because all of you will have read far more in the genre than I have. I read outside the genre, but I did have a look at Amazon's top 25 and did sort of tick for a vampire and tick for a werewolf and a tick for a part of a long series, and yesterday 19 out of the top 25 on Amazon were titles in a series, 11 out of 25 were vampire novels, and 3 or more out of 25 featured zombies or werewolves. So,
paranormal.
I agree with you, yes. Paranormal and paranormal romance is quite a big part of that as well. You know, the romance element hasn't been mentioned. That's really big. I mean, romance continues to sell well, and therefore, while vampires, werewolves, and zombies are hot, then paranormal romance will also sell well. The non-series titles out of that top 25 were all by very high-profile people, Neil Gaiman, Terry Goodkind, Gregory Maguire, probably partly because of Wicked the Musical as much as Wicked the Book, I think. But I was interested to see how many were series, and my experience last time I was negotiating a contract with my publisher, which was right at the quite recently and right at the start of sort of the economic downturn, whatever you want to call it, international instability and so forth, I was told that what readers want at this stage is series, because series make people feel comfortable, such as revisiting the same settings and perhaps the same characters, and they want something that will make them feel good, so something that, not necessarily happy endings, but, you know, well-concluded endings, and familiar worlds. So if you've created a fabulous world previously, then readers are going to go and watch the books in that world. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But certainly that was what I was told when I was trying to present something that was new to the publisher. No, we want something that's like what you did before, preferably with the same characters. That's what we will buy. However, if you have what they call a high concept idea for something new, and that high concept really does mean different, cutting edge, something so fabulous that your publisher is going to say, yes, I'll take it, thank you very much, then that's okay. I guess I'm speaking to you because I know that some of you are going to be writers as well as readers, and as somebody said, you know, today's dish du jour, which might be vampires, is going to be tomorrow's warmed up leftovers. So if you want to think of that fabulous cutting edge new idea that's going to be published, you've got to try to be a few steps ahead of what's popular now. Yeah.
Right, well, it's kind of depressing because I was going to that list you were giving about what's going to sell them, and I'm doing the exact opposite, I think.
You're ahead.
A bit depressing, yeah. No, actually, there is a dragon, but it's kind of backstory. It's funny, I took hot to mean sort of cool, as it were. And one of the interesting things is that all the names I'm thinking of, I don't think they're selling very well, but they are sort of super edgy and interesting. One of them was Homegrown's Margot Lanigan.
Okay.
Who, and again, interesting, you're talking about, you know, feel good? No. You know, comfortable? No. You know, she ticks all the boxes for the exact opposite, but she moves me in a way that I've not been moved by fantasy for a very long time. The other thing is, I think it's quite interesting how I'm impressed by writers who do something and I go, wow, I'm not really sure what you're doing there. I don't get that, but wow, it works. And Margot Lanigan definitely ticks that box. Another writer, Kelly Link.
Yeah.
Huge fan of. She's an American writer. And again, very odd, very odd. I mean, in a sense, she's sort of Margot Lanigan's nearest living relative on that side of the world, I think. But again, really bizarre, strange kind of narrative. Very often making no kind of sense at all, but just beautifully constructed and full of really odd stuff. They really are almost impossible to describe. I can't sort of sell them to you, as it were, because has anyone? I mean, I'm guessing a lot of you have read Lanigan.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
In what would have been the second part of what I was going to say, it's hot as in what sells now, and it's hot as in what we get is wonderful.
Yeah.
And I was going to say rather Lanigan, yeah. I was going to say Joe Abercrombie, so you might like to talk about Joe Abercrombie.
Joe, yeah, I mean, Joe, in a sense, I mean, I think he's actually hot in the other sense in that he is selling rather well. But his stuff is, despite being nominally subversive, it actually is pretty, it does plow pretty much an epic fantasy mainstream road. You know, he's telling stories about guys with swords and axes fighting it out. You know, in that sense, it's just huge and bringing a new sensibility. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. Jeff Vandermeer, I don't know if anyone's read him. Again, very weird, very odd sort of angled stuff that just makes you feel shuddery and uncomfortable and gives you some very strange ideas about humanity. If you haven't looked at his Ambergris stuff, City of Saints and Mad Men, which has a scene in it that I still can't really think about without getting slightly queasy. And it's not because it's hugely gory, it's just it's a very unpleasant idea. But I think that these are the things I sort of am impressed by in fantasy, and I'm probably doing them in my fantasy. It's the kind of things that where the real world really does unpick itself. And you suddenly find yourself in territory that is not in any way comfortable. I think it's quite interesting that a lot of, you know, the most successful fantasy tends to have maps. And mine, actually mine doesn't have a map now, but it will have very soon. I've been told. I already got somebody. We had competition. Because I basically, the book came out and four or five of the entry reviews said there's no map.
No,
I have people saying I can't understand where everything is because there's no map. And I tried really hard to say, look, it doesn't much matter where things are happening, it's what's going on.
Yeah,
Oh, it's only that one. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and also, I didn't want to have to work it out because I didn't know what was happening. If you draw your map, in a sense, I really admire Trudy, that she's got this map and she maps this stuff out, and then it's like, then she's going to put together what happens on top of that. And that would screw me. Because it would be a case of yourself going, well, Christ, I need them here, and there's a bunch of mountains in the way. What am I going to do? You know. And I come from SF, where you can get people across a planet in 45 minutes. So it's anyway, Max. Yeah. Completely lost the thread of that.
What's cool?
What's cool? Yeah.
See, that cool stuff will be hot in 2 years' time when we're over the feel-good, happy ending time. That stuff
will be easy. Might be right. Yeah. Don't know. Anyway, so there was definitely something about the maps, wasn't it? Oh yeah, Joe is also struggling with maps. Map fantasy. A lot of the stuff that I've been mentioning here doesn't have a map because that's exactly the point. You cannot get your grip. You cannot find reference in these worlds. That's what makes them fantastical. And I guess in a sense that this is fantasy that's kind of backing up against horror. But again, there's an interesting sort of failure of cool, as far as I'm concerned, with the paranormal stuff. is that it's kind of, it's gone from this idea of these really edgy otherworldly beasts like vampires and werewolves, and we've got to the stage where they've become so domesticated you can have them as boyfriend and girlfriend, you know. It's like when you can, you know, when you can sleep with someone and something and get up the next morning and still be alive. Which, that's a human being, you know. That's yeah, I kind of feel that the paranormal thing has betrayed the edginess of that in a sense. And although I did love Buffy for a couple of seasons, I think, you know, that was maybe where the rot started to set in. Although I was talking last night to some people about Stephanie Meyer, and I'm one of those people who hasn't read any of her stuff but delights in slagging her off. but I think, in a sense, I think a lot of people have been very unjust here because they're kind of blaming her for pursuing this rather icky romantic vampire dynamic. But to be honest, that's what Bram Stoker's Dracula was. You know, everyone likes to think back to, you know, sort of the vampire stuff. But actually, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula is fundamentally just like Twilight. You know, it's a bunch of sex dressed up as vampirism. And in fact, if you want to talk about edgy, the edgiest vampire story I ever read was in a porno magazine. I'm trying to remember how I happened to have one of those around. I really can't remember. But it was a while ago, and it was one in which this guy goes off. He's a London investigative journalist. He goes off to Transylvania to try and track down Count Dracula, or an analogue of Count Dracula. And there's an awful lot of oral sex in this short story. But what happens at the end is he discovers that the vampires are incredibly long-lived, and that much of it is true. But they're just a bunch of long-lived sort of humanoids. And they're built around this cult of oral sex. And what he says is that Stoker went out and did his research, but he was so horrified by this thing, this you know, this sort of cult of oral sex in Victoria. Just, he said there's no way he could present this to the Victorian audience. They would have just, you know, jailed him. So he looked at Christ, what am I going to do with this? So he twists it and turns it and turns it into this thing of blood and vampiric. And it's essentially the same motif, but involving death. And of course, then the Victorians went crazy for it and, you know, made him a very wealthy man. It's a completely mythical story, but it's just, it was very edgy. And, you know, I think I was very young, so this must have been back in the 70s. I think quite a lot of people who later became respectable authors did actually cut their teeth writing for porn. This might have been one. You know, who knows, maybe it might actually be some very, very respected fan, maybe Raymond Feistman. I don't know. It was you. but I thought it's interesting that that's the edgiest story I've ever read about a vampire, and it, and it was in a porn mag.
It's just an interesting vampire story, but it was in a porn mag. Well, it wasn't a porn mag, it was on the internet site where some people were writing stories, and it was like the X-rated fiction. Do you want to go? Well, basically, it didn't involve blood, it basically involved this person sort of catches the ball. He sleeps with a girl, and to his horror, they're joined after the union. And he starts to absorb her body, and what's actually happened is she was this kind of vampire, and she's decided she's sick of it. She's sick of having sex with people and killing them. So she somehow manages to reverse it so that he becomes that monster.
Right.
And then at first he gets to the point where he goes, I don't believe this happened to me, I don't believe this happened to me. And he goes off and he meets a new girl and she starts going down and and she gets really protests against it, so she starts trying to kill him, so he absorbs her head first.
Maybe this is the new becoming thing.
This guy hadn't actually finished this story, but it was brilliant because it was horrifying and yet strangely made kind of sense. Anyway, we completely crashed.
Yeah. What was this panel about? Lost thoughts in fantasy.
Sorry, a question.
Yeah.
If you can think of romance as being essentially the taming of men, is the vampire thing, is this because all the men have been tamed? And so
makes him dangerous again?
Yeah. So could it be some sort of either feminist or anti-feminist backlash that's making...
I think there's no doubt that a lot of this mythical stuff is mining very deeply understood, deeply set human truths. And yet, of course, you know, one of the deepest human truths is that men are
dangerous, you know, and women have to live around them because that's the way it works. And yeah, you're essentially entering into. I think one of the best ways, again, it's not. I guess it is fantasy, actually, isn't it? Is if you listen to the lyrics of Nick Cave songs, and he excavates that sentiment, that sensibility, really, really well. This idea of what are men good for? Well, not a lot, really. You know, they're really unpleasant. They'll betray you as soon as they look at you. They're violent. They're, you know, but at the same time, women are drawn to them. You know, because that's the way we're put together as a race. But I think you're right. Yes, I think. Very much. Although, I don't think it took long to subvert that and you end up with sort of the feminine vampire, the ideal, and the succubus, which of course is that Sumerian as a myth, so that goes back a long way. So I don't think it took long for the tables to be turned, you know, but no, yeah, there's no question about that. I think that as we've sort of come to realise it's not healthy to have large, muscular men going around just...
Vampires tend to be like these thin white. I actually have a bit of a theory of it's kind of like the woman gets to tame her man.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
no, I think you're right. I certainly wouldn't contest that. I think it probably has other, you know, offshoots from that, but I think that's what you're probably absolutely right.
Okay.
Question.
Is fantasy becoming more realistic?
I think back and I immediately think to Wizards of Earthsea and Michael Moorcock's Elric, and they're very much about consequences. There's always a balance.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. I think perhaps what has happened is that things have got more codified. So rather, you know, there's been an expectation that things need to be mapped out and explained, and, you know, if this guy can throw fireballs, well, why is that, you know? So, which I'm a bit uneasy about myself, because I kind of think the whole thing of the, you know, character says in this book, the guy's telling him about magic, and the guy says, but magic has rules, right? And he goes, who told you that?
He's basically saying,
you know, if there were rules to it, it wouldn't be magic. So I think when you write fantasy, you walk an uneasy line, because on the one hand, it has to make some kind of sense, but on the other hand, if it makes too much sense, then it loses its sense of wonder, of you know, the black, the darkness. There are trends. I think your identifying sort of part of a sub-trend. Yeah, guys like Abercrombie. Scott
Lynch.
Lynch,
yeah, it's interesting because Darren's list is Joe Abercrombie. When he talks about what's hot as and what's cool,
yeah,
it's Joe Abercrombie, Brent Weeks, Scott Lynch. This is the kind of book that owes a debt to Dave Gemmell, Robert E. Howard, and Fritz Lieber, rather than Tolkien.
Yeah, there's a kind of, but I mean, again, that's only one, that's not really realism in the broad sense. That's one aspect of realism. Those guys, what they're doing is they're sort of looking at the brutalistic elements of
you know, written.
Yeah, saying, you know, well, what's it like chopping people up with a battle axe? You know, but at the same time, that doesn't make them, you know, realistic in all their, necessarily in all their applications.
I sort of add to that summer, thinking of Joe Abercrombie in particular, because I think one thing we probably haven't talked about here is that some of the very strongest and most impressive fantasy that's being written at the moment is like that, partly because of the ideas and originality, sure, but also because they're people who have excellent writerly craft. So the kind of craft, the kind of understanding of character and the depth of the way they're writing, and I use Joe as an example and Margot Manigan as another example, is way beyond the run-of-the-mill fantasy that we've been, you know, reading. That's a great story and great world-building, but isn't going to plumb those depths of human character. So, sorry, I sound like I'm being irrelevant, but I guess I'm not, because that part of it, the character, whatever the world might be like, however many battle axes are chopping and magical fireballs, if the characters are real and if their journeys and their, you know, their difficulties speak to you as a real human being, that's what sort of lifts that fantasy out of the the mainstream, and I think with Joe Abercrombie and other writers as well, that often the characters are hideous, you know, very his characters in The First Law do all sorts of terrible things to each other, they have weaknesses and flaws, but they're all very real and you can understand where they're coming from and follow their journeys and feel a bit let down at the end when he doesn't, you know, he uses those sort of tropes of epic fantasy, but you know, certainly doesn't wrap it up neatly at the end the way he wants.
I think the ante has been upped in general, hasn't it?
Yes.
And that's been going on for a while now. I reckon that's the last 10 years of fantasy writing, really. You go back, guys, when I think Erickson, George R. R. Martin, that's when this case of, no, it really does have to be better written than this, guys. And they started that role, and I think everything that's come after has sort of built up from that.
I was just saying before that Assassins and Dragons look like, and I just think that the dragons have been used over and over, I think, quite a bit, but they're just used in different ways. Like recently I've been reading a series which is going on as I've been following the first one. It's the
Naomi, it's like 19th
century. So you have the dragons always been in the world, and they're just, that's how it's always been.
Yeah, dragons meet Patrick O'Brien.
So it's just, it's all through the book, the dragons, the tough dragons, all this.
It's her writing as well. Well, again, it all comes back to the writing. If the writing's good enough and the quality is there, and that lifts the story up and it lifts it above the rest of the mediocre that's written out there. And there is a lot of mediocre, but we have to wade through that to find it, and you find the good stuff. You find the good stuff through other people. Word of mouth is the big thing. And I mean, you can't pick what is hot. You know, to say that book, because that series is great. But if somebody else came along and wrote another dragon series with boats and battles, it's just a copy.
In clothing, there's the levels of fashion you've got. So when something's new and innovative, and you're almost looked at oddly for wearing it because it's so fresh. And then you've got when it's fashionable. And then you've got when it's turned to fad. Fads have been too often, it's doing too much, and everyone's been wearing it, and we're all sick of the death of it, like low-rise jeans. And it's interesting because Darren said that clearly a new weird is way to fad now. No one cares about new weird anymore. Yeah.
But I think actually that the... I got a first axe to grind because I was savaged by one of the new weird authors once in an argument. So I'm not going to sulk much. But I think the big problem with new weird was they talked far too much and wrote far too little. There is an alarming tendency in genre to, rather than sit down and write some good books, to, you know, maybe write a book and then sit and pontificate about, you know, why your book is so much better than a bunch of other stuff that's out there. And, you know, I think informed debate is a great thing, and I think one of the nice things about the SF and fantasy genre is how sort of enthusiastic everybody is and this sort of intense kind of engagement there is. But the downside of that is that you do sometimes find this kind of entrenched, embattled sort of... my fantasy is better than your fantasy. And unfortunately, that's what happened with the new weird thing, was it just became a soapbox. It became a point from which to yell at all these other people whose fantasy you didn't like. Which is a bit of a shame, really, because actually some of the people who you could define as new weird are actually very good. And someone I forgot to mention is Steph Swainston, who's got a book coming out, I think this year, called Above the Snowline. Which is, as I understand it, promises to essentially just be a very unpleasant love triangle played out in a fantasy world, and doesn't have much to do with the dynamics of that fantasy world at all. It has to do with these three characters, one of whom you've met in previous Swainston novels, just having this rather awkward tussle in this sort of little mountain village somewhere. It promises to be brilliant, you know, because again, Swainston's somebody who really just unleashes her talent and doesn't much care whether it fits on the map or not. So I recommend that, watch out for that Above the Snow Line. It should be very good. I've not seen it yet. I'm begging my editor to send me a copy as soon as she turns it in, but it should be good.
It seems to me that the covers of fantasy novels are getting a lot classier. For example, I noticed that your name there, you've got my favourite font on the front. It's called Bleeding Cowboy.
Yes, I was told that. Bleeding
Cowboy.
Sorry,
that's a beauty. It's a free font. You can Google it and download it.
And seriously, you're the second person within a month to tell me that. Someone got in touch with me the other day and was saying, oh, I'm doing an album cover, and we suddenly realised it's this font, and it's called Bleeding Cowboys, and isn't it cool?
It is free.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's a lovely font. It was originally this font, the title was going to be in that font, and then they were going to put my name in ordinary letters, and then they said they'd swap it around. I'm going, a little bit, because I'm coming from SF, they go, I'm going, a little bit sort of airy fairy, you know. but they insisted, but it's a beautiful font, yeah.
It's a lovely one. Now, I think Specfit has been cancelled for many years by its shithouse colours. But it didn't bother me. It's like, how do you find the good stuff when everything looks so awful? And yet now we're getting these lovely classy colours. Teresa perhaps can answer this one. Is this a deliberate ploy? Have they suddenly woken up to realise that class could sell books, or is there an answer, or is this just one of those
I think I've mentioned it several times, the jackets are becoming more mainstream. We're trying to increase the audience. We know there's a core audience out there for fantasy. Science fiction fans, there is a different core audience. And then there's a bigger general market which reads fantasy, the guys and girls in the office box, people who would never turn up here. And they were looking at the jackets game, and we know that we did see a decline in sales. And so we went, okay, we've got to do something. And so finally someone said, let's do something with a jacket. Let's give it a go. And it worked. And so now we've all woken up and gone, thank you. Things that I've been screaming for 10 years, they've finally woken up, as I'm sure all of you screamed in this room and everyone else has. They've woken up and gone, right, we're going to do some work on a jacket.
Stuff that they're not embarrassed to take on the train.
Exactly.
Somebody said to me once in an office situation, they said, when I said I wrote sci-fi, and they said, you know, I love sci-fi, but I can't find the good stuff because it all looks like crap on the shelves. How do I find the good authors?
Yeah, basically you find the good books by talking to your friends.
Well, that's true.
The best
way. I thought that was a really good point, though.
Yeah.
But it's, I think it's a bit like jazz, isn't it? It's I've had this because for a while I've been wanting to get into jazz, and I own, you know, Miles Davis Kind of Blue and two of the other albums that everyone has, but I don't really know much about it. But you kind of feel you can't don't want to go into a music shop and say, I've had to buy some jazz. and I think maybe people wanting to crack into the SF and fantasy market feel a bit like that about going into the bookshop and saying, fantasy, I don't mean sexual, you know, have you got any of that? What's that like? You know, they're terrified that people are going to fall about laughing at them, sort of, and spray a Klingon face on them or something.
The other thing is, within publishing, we've got more people who are coming through ranks who actually read it. There's so many people in publishing who, you know, this went, oh, fantasy, yeah, that's sort of pushed to one side. But you now have people who are actually interested in the genre, who actually read it for entertainment, who like the genre, and that's happening across all the publishing world.
There's tons of people that have published, like lots of the guys that I read, that hate to read fantasy, yeah. Supernatural, all that stuff. Amazing how many people do it. And it's initially there's that attitude by everyone else, who's reading fantasy? Everyone's reading.
Yeah, everyone's reading.
Another aspect, another reason for the covers getting better is that publishers are realising there's a lot of money to be made in things that cross over general to fantasy or hand battle to fantasy. Yes, because the trouble is...
I'd actually like to ask each of you in turn, you know, if you were going on a very long, just say airplane trip, but some of these series of you, so let's say space flight or whatever, you know, cabin baggage
restriction.
A desert island and you just happen to have a bookstore there. What sort of books would you want to read in the fantasy genre? You know, are you going to go straight to the assassin section, or are you going to go straight to the dragon section, or dark fantasy? Each in turn, Juliet, if you want to start.
Okay, well, you know, first up, probably if I had full choice, I wouldn't actually take fantasy books. I'd probably take something that was really going to be very, very meaty, so I'd probably take, you know, classics of literature plus some modern literary fiction that I would enjoy, plus something funny that had you get fantasy, so we'll
do very limited
books. I'm going to say everything by Jack and Harry, because I think that they reward reading and reading and reading again, and because not only is it sort of standard, in some ways it's standard fantasy, but it has the most wonderfully creative world and it's brilliantly written. So I think if you go to read something over and over again, it's got to be well written. So I have all of the things that you've written in that series so far, plus the new ones that are coming out.
Sorry, can you spell that last name for us?
Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, first name Jacqueline, very erotic. Fabulous. She's an American writer. And I will take the Joe Abercrombie's, including the new one that's coming out this year, which we'll hope is that I enjoy as much as I do those other ones. Original mythology, so I would take, you know, the Icelandic saga, and I'd take a huge book of Celtic fairy tales, and I might actually take some Angela Carter, which would be fun and give me a laugh, you know. And if you go to the rest of the day, take a look at the book.
I can't play favourites. No, I couldn't play favourites, but I would have a wide collection. I would assassin, adventure, just a quest. It would be something for everyone. And I take Philip Pullman. I would take Philip Pullman. I reread Philip Pullman every year. And I still far too much of him. I need a commission on that man. But I couldn't pick. I really couldn't. There are just too many good ones. I mean, I'm one of those people, you know, you ask me my favourite book, and it's a book I'm currently reading. That library would have to be damn big.
Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, please work to both.
I probably would take Lord of the Rings, because I haven't had a chance to read. I keep starting to read the first one, or reading the whole one, the first one, and starting to read the second. I never quite get into the whole thing, so there's perfect opportunity to get through the whole thing.
What about All the Lost Tales?
Yeah, the entire Tolkien range. Because I quite enjoyed the Silmarillion and all those.
Oh, no!
I read a chapter a night, which is the best way to think it through, because it's almost like a little cluttered. Each chapter's quite...
By the time I got to the end, I'd forgotten this in the beginning.
It doesn't matter. I'd probably grab a whole lot of stuff I've never read before, but by authors I've never read before, because I'm actually quite a disloyal reader. I'll read something and go, that author's fantastic, next author. Because like I've sampled what they can write, I want to know what's going on next, you know, I want to know what the next person's doing. And I take 101 when I used to use a coconut, because I'm guessing I'm going to need that one day.
Coconut hide,
coconut hat,
I think actually, yeah, I think Trudy's got a point. I would aim to take someone with me that I've not read. So, I mean, I think in terms of fantasy, probably George R. R. Martin stuff, which I've still not got around to. I read quite a lot of Martin's science fiction when he was writing short stuff way back when. I always really liked it. So I keep meaning to. Martin and Erickson are both guys that I, especially Erickson, because he's been really nice to me. He got in touch, he emailed me once and said, oh, I hear you might be writing a fantasy novel, would you like me to blurb it? Well, that's not bad on not having, he hadn't read it.
Can I just interject and say, taking George R. R. Martin's books along to a desert island is like torture, and you get to read to almost the end of the book over and over again.
Well, air dropped in, yeah.
So I'd probably take a few of the Martin fantasy just to see what they're like, and because they are quite meaty.
I did actually take Deadhouse Gates by Sinatra on the way to a desert island. That's exactly what I did. I went to the Dominican Republic, and that's what I took to read. And that's all I needed to read for the whole time I was there, because Deadhouse Gates is, you know. I think this is going to sound really sort of literary, but I think I'd take Pynchon. I've already done this once at this convention. I hate to sort of beat the thing over the head. But Pynchon's Mason and Dixon, for example, fits the description of a fantasy as far as I'm concerned. It's about these two guys, Mason and Dixon, cartographers, members of the Royal Society, who went and drew the Mason Dixon line to separate North and South states in the US. But whenever Pynchon writes a novel, what he does is he takes the context that the novel's taking place in, and he just assumes that whatever those people believe to be true is. So you end up with this sprawling novel that goes to South Africa, it crosses to the islands in the middle of the Atlantic, then across to North America, and then back to Britain. But it's got all this incredibly beautiful mythological stuff in it that is true. So at one point they're hacking their way through the jungle trying to map the line out, and they come across these guys who've seen a golem. And they really, really have seen it. It's, you know, there's no question about it, it actually exists. And there's a flying mechanical duck, because apparently back in the 1700s they were talking about creating an automaton duck. That's one of the mathematicians back then had this idea about it. They've got a hollow earth and these weird creatures that come out of it. There is the Jesuit communications web, the World Wide Web that the Jesuits have set up to communicate with Chinamen and wires. Fiendish Chinese cunning is used to send messages up into the sky on these long wires, and they're transmitted around the world so that instantly the Vatican can know what is happening in North America. Just beyond belief, you know. But again, he just creates it, and there it is, and it exists. And that is a big, big, big book. It's massive. And it's also got the kind of literary depth that I would look for if I was going to be stuck on a desert island, in that you literally will need to read it two or three times before you actually caught all of the references and the stuff and realise what the subplots mean and so forth. I've only read it once so far, and there's a whole stack of stuff I have to go back and read again because I didn't quite get it. Pynchon, a couple of his, Against the Day, which I don't know if any of you have seen that. You'll have seen it in shops holding up the building probably. I mean, again, it's 1,001 pages or something in hardback. This is. A magazine I read called Prospect, they actually had a Pynchon correspondent sending back reports from reading Against the Day. Four different reports. I'm halfway through now. But again, that's set in sort of 18, it comes from 1893. The Chicago World's Fair through to the early 1920s, and again all the things that those people believed are assumed to be true, so the whole thing of spirituality and ghosts as a scientific proposition, the Conan Doyle thing, that's assumed to be true. Goblins in mines are assumed to be true. They have to, when they are running through the mine in this place in Colorado, they have to escape the goblins. It's got everything under the sun. Oh, ball lightning. My favourite ever. This is Pynchon. This is what Pynchon will do for you. I'll give you a quick recap of this, and then you'll know whether you want to read the book or not. Out of nowhere, it's clear he's invented this as on the fly. He's talking about this guy who's been left with a small daughter, a baby daughter to bring up. And he's just working his way through the Midwest. And he's kind of learned to be a bit of a scientist, because you can make money from that. So he's doing a bit of sort of electrical stuff as these things were emerging, and he's sort of seen as half as a shaman, because no one's quite sure whether this is, you know, what is this science, is it magic, whatever. Anyway, one night he decides he'll be a lightning conductor salesman, because that apparently made a lot of money back then. He blows into town, and they say, what kind of lightning do you deal with? And he goes, all sorts, we've got all sorts, yeah, you name it, sheet lightning, fork lightning, all sorts. He goes, what about ball lightning? No problem. He's never seen ball lightning. Goes to the house that is infested with ball lightning, he watches all night, and the ball lightning appears and it rolls down the corridor towards him. It pops up and floats in front of his face. So he goes, hello. And the ball lightning starts to talk to him. and so he takes it home with him. He takes it back to the wagon and he gives it to his daughter as a friend. And the daughter's looking at her. The daughter's very cool. The young female characters in Finch are always super cool, sort of Buffy types. And the daughter, she's going, you know, Dad, other little girls have, like, brothers and sisters. So, what's this? And he goes, well, it's sort of the same thing, kind of, you know. And then she gets to really love the sport little ball and describe how they're riding across the prairie in the wagon. And she's in the back nodding off to sleep with a book. And the ball lightning floating by her head, lighting the book. and it goes on and on like this for about, all of 10 lines. And then one night, as they're out on the prairie, there's a huge storm from one side of the sky to the other, and the ball line's getting all agitated, and she's going, you have to go, don't you? Yeah, it's my people, they're calling me. She says, so what's going to happen to you? It's hard to describe. I'm going to be absorbed, I'll be taken up. But it doesn't hurt, it's not a, you know, it's not a thing to be afraid of. It's you know, it's good. It's a good thing. You know, I really enjoyed my time here among you, and I'm sitting there, you know, wiping a tear from my head. And I think, you bastard, 10 lines, and it had nothing to do with the story at all. You can see him; he's writing away, and he's going, "I'm going to push this a little bit and see where we go." It's a jazz riff in a fantasy novel. It just improvises the whole thing. Again, today is not about that, or indeed about anything else that I could readily explain, but it is 1,070-odd pages long. It's a huge print. And most of it is as beautiful and as quirky as that. It's about everything under the sun. So Pynchon would be me, definitely.
How do you spell Pynchon?
P-Y-N-C-H-O-N. But a warning, if you are going to read Pynchon, and you haven't before, you really have got to just go with it. So don't expect that the story will start to make much sense at any time. You know, really just roll with it. Just read it for the pleasure of the text you happen to be reading at the time. And if it stops being a pleasure to read, then just leave it and maybe come back to it some other time. Because it will not work if you try and control it as a book. It's beyond that. It just doesn't work. Some people don't like it because of that. And you won't understand all that. I didn't understand, like, so there's huge amounts I didn't understand. Again, people get upset when they don't understand something in a book. I'm not going to like Pynchon much. You just have to get... He does his best. I mean, he doesn't try and, you know, sort of dictate, say, oh, I know so much more than you. It's not a postmodern thing in that sense. It's very much, come with me, I'm going to tell you some really cool stuff about what they thought electricity was like in the 1920s. Yeah.
Has it made a gateway into...
Yes, Thomas Pynchon's Vineland, which is set in the 60s, it's in America, in West Coast America, 1960s and 1980s. And it's basically the story of, and again, it's full of fantasy, because all the things that the hippies believed in the 1960s are true. So dolphins really are, you know, the souls of humans come back to lead us into a better life. That's 380 pages long. It's a much tighter sort of thriller context, a very easy read. And if you enjoy that, then I think then the bigger ones will be for you. You could get stranded in one of the bigger ones and sort of think, but no, Vineland, definitely.
Yeah, so like, how
did you
get published?
Like,
how do you still get kind of stuff to
be? I think he's considered to be, you know, sort of the giant of American fiction. Sorry, he's outside genre fiction,
Very good. And his first novel, Vineland, which was published in 1963, which is again about colonialism, about the war, about regeneration, about God knows what else. It was at a time, I think, when there was a loosening of ties in the American publishing industry, and they were suddenly thinking that, you know, odd stuff was cool. And he sort of got in the door, and that was it. And once you, because it's pretty addictive. Once you've read it, it's hard to go back.
I'm not saying it's in no way not good. I just think, you know, everything I've heard from Swan from Six to be that if you're a writer, it's, you know, hard to get anywhere by pushing on. But that's the question. Yeah. Thanks.
No, but
he's nuts. That's the other thing you need to know. That's the other thing you need to know about Pynchon. Quite seriously, in the nicest possible way, he is barking mad. He's obsessive. He writes one novel a decade, more or less. And it's because basically, and this is back before the internet existed, he will just disappear for 10 years, finding out what kind of glass they made in Venice in 1740. I mean, and he'll know, and he'll come back and he'll say, and he'll make it interesting. That's the weird thing. But he's nuts, completely.
Shall we perhaps make a prediction for what might be cool in the future, like what to look out for?
What's
not
running
out? Well, I'm talking, I suppose, in... Well,
what is the title?
It could be a title, I suppose. It could be a thing like Vampire Hunters. I'd say Karen Warren. I've been predicting big things for Karen Warren for a very long time. Do you know who Karen Warren is? Australian author. If you like Margaret Olean, you'll love Karen Warren.
Okay.
She's having a book published in the UK, I believe.
Angry Robot. Oh, I'm starting to hear stuff about that.
So, anything else?
I wouldn't try to predict. I just think that if you write well enough, then you're more, good writing is good writing, whether it's fantasy, science fiction, mainstream, something that's of excellent quality, with good ideas and writerly technique.
I kind of hesitate to say try and write the next thing, because writing takes a long time, and by the time you write it and the publisher finds it and it gets all through the process before it even gets printed and gets out there, it's no longer news. It's hard. You just write what you love and hope that you happen to be really trained.
Yes, that's it. Write what you love and hope you happen to be trained at the end.
Do you want to make any predictions on?
At the moment, as I said, I mentioned before, it's all people do want something a bit lighter. They want something a bit greasier. They want something which does tie up the loose ends with a happy ending sometimes, most of the time at the moment, because of what we're going through. And I think that in the next 2 years that will change. We'll be fed up with all the lightness and happiness, and people will want something that's a bit darker, a bit edgier. It won't be the paranormal, because that will be passe. It will be somebody hunting down and killing all the vampires and killing all the werewolves and killing all the paranormal.
I think the place to look, I mean, there are two things. One is a book that I keep getting shouted at by my editor to look at, which is The Forest of Pansy Tea, which is a YA zombie book in which the word zombie is never ever used. And it's not really about the zombies at all.
No happy endings in it.
And there's no happy endings.
That's what I think. Carrie Ryan, I'll send you a copy.
Carrie Ryan, The Forest of Pans and Teeth, apparently is very good. I'm going out on a limb here, but my editor doesn't usually push something this hard unless he knows that I'll like it. So I go for that. The other thing I'll say is, if I were you, I would be looking in games. Video games, because it seems to me that that's where the really cool stuff is coming from now, and especially in fantasy, horror, and the stuff that's out on the edge of human experience. It's getting easier and easier to do this stuff in game format, and increasingly I'm knocking my head against really, really interesting concepts in games. And there are things you can do in gaming as a medium that you can't in either fiction or film, novel fiction or film. And I'm going to be very interested to see what the next 5 years bring in terms of good gaming. I mean, like anything else, 90% of everything is crap. So there's a lot of awful games out there. But I'm very excited about what gaming is possibly going to deliver to fantasy in the next 5 years. I think there's going to be some very, very interesting stuff. So that's get yourselves an Xbox.
No
games on PS3.
How should we?
Main copy still remains the first thing to want.
I will indeed.
And Timurair. Please. Enjoy.
Who was the person who asked about the vinyl, the Pynchon entry book? Is that you? Okay.
Cool.
Where's my entry fantasy book? I'll sign it for you.
I just read it. Oh,
you just read it? Who wants some? No, I'm not going to throw a book. That's just taking it too far. Yeah, I think you were quite vocal. No, you were quite. Yeah, yeah.
You
were.
The two shells. Yes, you.
I say that's what got me into reading fantasy. I never read fantasy before that. I know it sounds very tainted because, you know, I work for a company you work for, but it's very true. And since then I've been reading fantasy and I love it, and broadening out, like, you know, Christopher Shaw, all I like lots of stuff, and it's always read sci-fi, never read fantasy. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks. Kirky, this should go to you for putting me in the most uncomfortable position of trying to... You asked a very good question.
I'm not sure I'm the last time prize
And this is such good. This is like 1970s, really good sci-fi. Thank you very much.
Thank you.